Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. From a local business to a global corporation.
Partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is the Daily Tech News Show for Wednesday, December 26th, 2018. From DTNS headquarters in Los Angeles, I'm Tom Merritt.
And from Studio Feline, I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Chang.
Welcome to our listener co-host show. This is the annual episode where we invite some of our supporters, some of our members, some of the DTNS audience folks that we do the show for to come on here and talk to us about what they do and why they like technology and why they listen. Joining us this time, we're very happy to have pianist and composer Justin Coughlin. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here. Been a big fan since Buzz Out Loud and iFi for the iPhone. So this is very exciting for me.
Yeah. All right, good.
That's fantastic.
We go way back.
Yeah. No, thanks for being willing to do this. Also, Michael Parker, who's a purchasing manager at ACD Distribution. Thank you, Michael, for joining us.
Hello.
And we'll be talking to everybody about what they do, including our other guest, Liam Hughes, senior software developer at Focus Software. Liam, thanks so much.
G'day. Glad to be here.
Ah, you're in Australia, are you?
I am.
So it's December 27th for you.
Yes, I'm in the future.
Yeah, we're all kind of in the future in a way, but you're even more in the future.
Yes.
Well, thank you guys so much. I know there are so many people who respond every year who want to be on this show, and we really appreciate all that response. And I always wish we could just have everybody, but for reasons of listenability and production resources and whatever, we have to limit it to three. And I think we picked three folks who can represent some interesting viewpoints. And if you didn't get picked to be on the show this year, keep asking, keep trying, keep looking for those announcements. We'll start by talking to Justin. So you're not just a pianist and composer, you're also a touring musician and educator. And you also can't see, you're blind, right?
That is right. Totally blind. That's pretty much my story.
I told it all for you. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no worries. Yeah. I guess just a little bit of background on where I'm coming from is, I play jazz piano. Don't hold that against me.
I love jazz, but that's all right.
You know, all kinds of music. But as a jazz pianist, I think for a long time, my aspirations were pretty low. But a crazy thing happened about almost 10 years ago. A buddy of mine decided he wanted to make a film about one of our teachers, a guy named Clark Terry. And he wanted to film. He filmed for about 4 years and threw me in the mix as one of Clark's students. And after the 4 years, they actually made this movie. Crazy thing happened. Is that through the filming of the movie, we met Clark's first student, who was Quincy Jones from the 50s.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So the movie gets made and it gets out there. And ever since meeting Quincy, I've been working with him. And that's kind of because, you know, as a jazz pianist, my goal was to be a good local musician back in Virginia. But now I'm living out in the LA area. And when I'm home, I'm here with my guide dog, Candy.
Aww.
And when I'm on the road, accessible tech is extremely helpful.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the tech you use to get by in your day, both at home and on the road.
So, I probably would start to say that just technology in general, it for me and my experience of it is split into two parts, before the iPhone 3GS and after. The 3GS is when Apple introduced VoiceOver, the screen reader for the iPhone. And that was groundbreaking because, first of all, I didn't think I would ever use a touchscreen. But they created an interface where basically I drag my finger across the screen. It tells me what's there. And not only do I know what's there, but I know where it is, which is a new thing for a blind user. The other thing was that I could actually have something that was cool, like an iPhone. Before then, you know, blind tech was always quite old, very expensive, and, you know, definitely not cool. So the iPhone is this Swiss Army knife of very useful tools. So when I'm on the road, I'm, you know, hotels are always different. So FaceTime for me is a godsend because I call somebody back at home who I trust, and we walk through the room and they tell me where the thermostat is. I set the thermostat. We go into the bathroom and I find out which one of the four identically shaped bottles is the shampoo and the conditioner. Because I don't want to wash my body with conditioner. So that was big, being able to use that to get sighted assistance remotely. And then PayPal and Venmo, of course, everybody uses them. But for me, as a band leader, this eliminates the stress that I used to have with, like, do I have to write checks for my band members? And I don't really want somebody else writing the checks for me. You know, I don't want them giving themselves more money than I want them to. So PayPal just simplifies everything. And I'm using the same tech and the same apps as everybody else, but it's
in a different way.
Yeah. It's been extremely.
Justin, here's a question I have for you because we try to cover assistive technology as much as possible, on the show, because it's important. You know, most recently we covered the idea of, Instagram, photos having, it read out loud descriptions, either by AI or if a user submitted it. How much are some of these technologies really lacking for somebody who's actually living and breathing this?
I'm glad to see any developments. I'll say when Facebook rolled out their AI described pictures, it wasn't too exciting. So when AI does it, I'll see that somebody posted a picture and it'll say, so-and-so is in the picture. And I'm like, well, that's cool, but also not terribly helpful or descriptive.
Right. The context is lacking.
If a user is able to go in and actually enter in text to really paint a picture for the blind user, that is cool. And of course, if AI gets better, then we might have more substantial things coming from that. But it's all baby steps. I'm just happy to see any progress. That's always exciting, and to have it covered in any news platform is just always good to see.
Yeah.
I liked seeing the Microsoft story that you guys reported on about the closed captioning in real time. Because all this stuff helps. And Microsoft actually has been doing a great job. They've rolled out Soundscape, which is a GPS app. It's free. I've downloaded it on the iPhone, and they've also rolled out another app called Seeing AI, and, you know, that reads currency. So I actually know what dollar bills I have.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's just good to see things being rolled out by the major companies, not by like a specialized blindness tech company, which is good too. But sure. it's even better when it's mainstream, because then, you know, I feel included.
Now, I know that Roger said that you had a question you wanted to ask us about.
Yeah. I've just been curious. I've been, you know, watching these or listening to these podcasts for a long time. I'm curious, what if somebody's watching the video, what do they see? Like, is it like Brady Bunch? Is it that kind of thing? Is it Hollywood Squares or...
Well, it's not unlike that, okay. I suppose. I mean, if you're talking about the Google Hangouts experience, I mean, as far as Tom and Roger and I go, and, you know, all of our regular contributors, we all kind of have our little backgrounds. Certainly at my house, you'll see a dog and two cats walking around behind me very regularly. You know, at Roger's house, his daughter maybe makes an appearance every so often. Tom's pretty good about all his furry friends away. But yeah, that's an interesting question. Because of course we know a lot of people listen to our audio show but don't watch it. But if you could never watch it, you know, what just does it look like?
Because, you know, I go back to, you know, I listened to Buzz Out Loud and I just imagined a round table. And I don't even know if that's correct. But, you know, because you hear things and you just paint a picture automatically in your mind. But yeah, it was just something that I wondered about.
Yeah, so the video automatically switches. It's full screen for each one of us. So it's not like Brady Bunch in that way.
Okay.
So each one of us is on screen as we're talking. Hangouts will automatically switch to the person that's talking. And then down in the bottom, we have little chiclets where we can sort of see the other person's camera.
Right now it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 of us.
Yeah, because there's two Rogers.
Chilling down there. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So it's mostly full screen though.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah. Well, let's talk to Michael a little bit. Michael's a purchasing manager for a distributor of hobby toys and games. Michael, what kind of content? What is it? Is it tabletop, RPG, all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So we focus on analog hobby games and toys. So we service a lot of independent retailers. So, you know, in the LA area, there's, you know, like Gamescape, or up in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's a number Endgame out in Oakland, as well as Gamescape in San Francisco and San Rafael. So these independent retailers are getting product, Magic the Gathering, Dungeons and Dragons, other role-playing games, other board games, miniatures games, hobby supplies, all of these things. And the majority of them are purchasing from distributors or directly from the manufacturer, depending on their relationship or how big they are. Like a lot of these small independent specialty stores don't necessarily want to have a relationship with, you know, 50 to 60 different manufacturers that might be their top sellers. So they'll work with distributors who aggregate that content down and, you know, combine shipments to make shipping more reasonable and justifiable and things like that. And that's a lot of what. So I am on the not sales end. I'm on the purchasing end. So I work with the manufacturers to bring in inventory to our warehouses, and then our sales team takes that inventory and resells it back to those retailers.
So the hobby shop buys from the distributor because that makes it a little cheaper to get a lot of things at once. And you're the guy that makes sure the things are on the shelves when they order them.
Correct.
Okay. Let's make sure I got that right.
Yep.
So what kind of technology do you use? I'm sure you use a lot. I mean, we talk about logistics quite a bit on the show.
So the interesting thing that I thought that I could kind of share was just kind of particularly when you talk about like Amazon or some of these really big players kind of in the supply management space. Amazon obviously operates a number of warehouses that are both direct to consumer, as well as they operate their services platform. A lot of the technology that they're starting to develop, you know, is, you know, probably years to a decade down the line for what we could start using. So a lot of what we're using is a little bit more designed specifically for kind of our, you know, the cottage industry that I kind of operate in. So from a purely technological perspective, a lot of like we're using modern warehousing techniques and things like that. But a lot of what we do kind of from a supply chain management is we're really excited about some of these developments that we're going to start seeing down the line, particularly when you're talking about being able to, you know, verify shipments through blockchain or getting a better, you know, getting better analytics as far as kind of how our delivery schedule works. Because a lot of that is stuff that we're still needing to do manually. And when you're talking about, you know, games and toys and books and things like that, a lot of those industries are, you know, stretched back into a lot of the pre-internet days. So we're working with, and particularly us as a distributor who works with a large volume of manufacturers, we're dealing with wide variances of technological level infrastructure within those manufacturers. And then we need to kind of translate that into, you know, how that's coming across in our system. And ultimately to be able to give the retailers and the end consumers the information about, well, I want X product, I want X game, or I want X book, or I want these toys. You know, when are we going to get that? Managing that information flow.
You sound like the kind of person that people would assume would be worried about automation eliminating your job. Do you feel like machine learning and AI is just going to make your job better, or are you worried about eventually someday, they won't need me?
I'm not as worried about that specifically with automation. I mean, I'm looking forward to automation coming in and taking pieces of my job away that I have to do manually. I long for the day that I can make certain elements of my workflow easier. So, but there are definitely things I think in the supply chain that are going to be automated out of the human intervention. And I'm not necessarily worried about those. And specifically in kind of our in my industry, a lot of it is user tastes. I mean, is similar things you would see in, you know, kind of like book publishing or fashion or things where the end consumer preferences are very high, you know, influence the market quite a bit. You're still going to have kind of tastemakers or gatekeepers that try and distill information from kind of early in the supply chain process to anticipate what is going to be popular with end consumers down the line.
Yeah, I feel like that sounds like the kind of thing that AI is good for in medicine, right? In medicine, you don't get rid of the doctor. The AI helps the doctor diagnose by suggesting things. I feel like AI could help suggest things to look at to capture those early tastemaker situations, but you still need the human touch in there.
Absolutely. So one of the tools that we've used is we've used inventory analytics software that kind of helps, you know, grade products along, you know, with varying criteria and then throws up, you know, basically infographics or metrics to say, here are the number of products that you have in these categories and these categories. These are the ones that have this level of high velocity versus these are low velocity. And you can, you know, start using that information intelligently to say, well, I now have these that are in an accelerated curve for what I need to purchase. Maybe I need to go look at ordering more, or these have slowed down. Maybe I need to look at start divesting myself of inventory or not worrying about restocking that particular line. So we've used a lot of that, particularly in the toy market, which is somewhat new for my company. We've grown into that space in the last couple of years working with those toy stores, which is all new for us. So we're taking a lot of that type of metrics information a lot more seriously, as we need to react quicker because we don't necessarily have the in-house expertise to have a baseline of the product as much as we have with the things we've carried for decades, like, you know, board games and card games and things like that.
You know, Michael, you mentioned Amazon a few minutes ago and the idea of, you know, obviously your company has gone above and beyond trying to, you know, figure out how to best sell to your audience. But let's say you were a little bit newer to the market. How much does that sort of big conglomerate perhaps help a smaller seller that might not have the exposure and the reach otherwise versus hurt it?
So from one of the things that we've seen trending wise just over the last several years is that things like the Amazon Marketplace and Kickstarter have really opened up the potential for a lot of independent creators. I mean, in the same way that it's done for a lot of industries where getting directly to the end consumer has never been easier. So we see that there's a lot of product getting out into the market that, you know, maybe it doesn't actually need a lifespan in distribution, but, you know, this person who's creating, a handful of games on Kickstarter can fulfill those directly to, you know, his audience, or, you know, and maybe he sells the remainder to, you know, on the Amazon Marketplace. I mean, Justin talks all the time about how, you know, his games, you know, can be found on Amazon, and for him and his audience, that's, you know, a perfectly reasonable and logical place for him to sell his products. There's such a wide option for products, particularly for retailers, both online as well as brick and mortar stores, that not everything needs to necessarily be in a brick and mortar store. And what we see is that there's kind of a small divide between these publishers that kind of are able to kind of focus on their niche within the market, as well as, people who are still kind of operating off of the traditional publishing model where, you know, a bigger publisher kind of takes it, does a large print run, brings inventory, and then sells directly to their direct accounts, big box stores, as well as, you know, into distribution or directly to those kind of smaller independent stores.
So you're kind of in between. There's the direct through Amazon approach, and there's the direct from the manufacturer approach. Do you see that there's a good future for that middle approach that sort of helps connect the dots?
Yeah, I mean, and I think overall, as kind of the market itself kind of grows, just with these other avenues and, you know, technology kind of helping these other avenues basically support themselves, maintain themselves, right? The other thing that we're seeing is that communities for end consumers are growing Every year there's more and more like local conventions for mm-hmm. for hobby games and, you know, just nerd culture in general, that you know, games are a part of that culture for a large number of those communities, and the technology that kind of helps support those communities and those networks mean that there is still opportunities for people who are either at conventions or supporting them or supporting local communities through their local shops. Before working in distribution, I managed a retail store in the San Francisco Bay Area for a number of years. And one of the models that we focused on was focused on kind of the Starbucks third space model, mm. where you have work, you have home, and then you have a place where that's your community center. And for a lot of people who are enthusiasts for hobby products, you know, that game store is that third space where, in addition to obviously offering the retail component of it, there's the community that's managed, whether they're playing in store or they're just, you know, using the store as a springboard to play elsewhere or, you know, form local home groups out of that type of situation. And, you know, developments in social media and being able to kind of manage communities has only enhanced that ability for a retailer to be able to kind of curate their communities and engage with them better in the same way that a content creator would.
Well, let's get to Liam, who has been patiently waiting, always patiently waiting for the rest of the world to be in the same day, but and also waiting for things like the U.S. to get tap to pay. Liam Hughes, senior software developer at Focus Software. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into app development.
So from the earliest time I can remember, I've wanted to be a computer programmer. My dad introduced us to computers very early. When it came time for me to go to university, I went and did computer science. Had a bit of a diversion for a little bit, but including doing some consulting with IBM. I've been here at Focus now for about 6 years, doing web-based application development.
And did you use any particular technology to help find work, to help get your job?
Pretty standard, really. JobBoard. Went on a job site. My contract with IBM was coming to a close, so I just went online and found this application development job in country New South Wales, which is rare, but I was very excited at the opportunity.
So, Liam, my question to you is, how many folks do you... deal with, work with on an everyday basis that you don't see?
That I don't see.
You're not in the, you know, the same hemisphere with.
Yeah. So, I mean, for our company, we have sales and customer support in the UK, the US and Australia, but all the software development is done here in Orange. So my team of about 12, we have some contact with our customer service staff, for sure, but a lot of that is obviously asynchronous with time zones. So we use email and Jira. But yeah, the core team is here in Orange.
How long have you been doing app development for again?
So I guess about 7 years all up. I had a crack at iPhone development. But the sales didn't take off. It was a great learning experience though. And I did a bit of contract work, but, full time for about 6 years.
It feels like your area of software development has been fairly stable, from the outside, right? Whereas like you say, iPhone app development kind of, you know, has its rises and falls. It's getting more stable now too. Does it feel that way from the inside, or would you dispute that notion?
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess for us, we, as a company, we've had the subscription model for a very long time before it was, I think, popular. We haven't always had to worry about big splashy releases. As long as we're consistently providing value to our customers, then they stick around and we are able to keep working away at our applications.
Is there a dream application that you would like to work on one day?
I used to have lots of
yeah, after your IBM experience. You're like,
I used to have dreams. Well, no, I mean, family life takes up a lot of my time, so I don't have a lot of time for side jobs at the moment. I've got a notebook full in my Evernote of different ideas, but nothing that stands out.
Well, and Roger said that you had a question for us.
Yeah, I guess a few years ago, I got back into reading, partially because I wanted to do the whole no screen time before sleep thing. I know Tom reads a book or two. I was just wondering if each of you, if there was one book that would be your absolute favorite, or perhaps one book that you have learnt the most from.
Ooh. Well, if we're talking about fiction, and this one's a little obvious, but Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is my absolute favorite book. I've read it like 100 times.
Wow.
It's just the funniest thing I've ever read in my life. Movie, not so funny. Didn't work. It just didn't translate, in my opinion. But that would be my favorite book that I still have. Like, it's like a very weathered paperback that's under my TV right now. But otherwise... well, I don't know. I mean, Tom and Roger, please weigh in.
I'll confess to rereading Dune on my Kindle, because that was one of the first things I got. Unfortunately, it had us a lot of typos, because I think they just did an OCR of the actual book. But it was one of the first books that I read, not as a kid, but like a teenager, where, you know, the whole allegory of the book and stuff was such an important cornerstone of the entire what would be the series, although I've only read the first book. But I've always enjoyed it because it both as literature, but also because one of the biggest, fattest books I've ever willingly sat through and read, and not like kind of just like, I don't ever want to do this again. So it's one of those things. Unfortunately, the past 2 years, ever since actually I moved down to LA, I actually haven't had that much time, because like you, I have kids that cry for my attention constantly, and it's not conducive at all to reading the printed page.
Well, I've mentioned this a million times, but for those who haven't heard, The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick is kind of my favorite book of all time. Just because I'm a big fan of alternate history and what could be and differences, and it's set in the 60s, you know, so it's got that retro flavor to it. As far as the book that I've learned the most from would be hard for me to pin down. I was very influenced by the Clutrain Manifesto, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, for all things, getting things done. Those have all kind of contributed to the way I put things together, but I don't know if there's one book that I've learned the most from. I feel like it's just kind of get pieces like the Tao Te Ching, and everything just adds a little something as you go along. It's a hard one for me to answer in that respect.
Yeah, I might be the minority, but I don't read a lot of nonfiction, and it's not because I don't enjoy it. It's because I feel like I kind of live that. So when I kind of sit down and want to escape, I want it to be into a, you know, another world. So all of the books that I love the most and are, and, you know, dearest to my heart are fiction. And that's my own sort of escapism thing going on. But I'm sure a lot of people share that sentiment with me.
I'm actually curious if Justin or Michael have an answer to this question as far as a favorite book.
Man, I think it's whatever I'm currently reading, I guess.
It's all, you only read a book that's better than the last one. That's I like
it's
that.
Like I that. I probably revisit Terry Pratchett's books, like,
okay,
pretty frequently. I've read them all, so going to bed, that's a fun one. That's a lot of them too.
Yeah,
so.
you've got a whole universe to choose from there. There's what, 30 some plus books, I think.
Yeah, and I assume those are, you're listening to the audiobooks.
Audible.
That one.
Yeah.
The audio reader for the Terry Pratchett books is fantastic. I could not read those in print because I didn't understand the joke until it was read to me with a British accent.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Michael, do you have an answer to your favorite book?
If we're talking about the most influential book on me, it's probably Roger Zelazny's Chronicles of Amber series. I reread that series probably once a year-ish. As far as one that I've actually like learned the most from, I read a book in college by Simon Sinek called Start with Why. And it was an interesting book about it's kind of about the process of why we engage with brands as kind of a meta term. Hmm. It talks about Walmart and Apple and things of that nature, but it talks about, you know, kind of how, you know, what speaks to us about brand loyalty to a certain degree, why someone is, you know, always going to use an Apple product because they like the, you know, not just because of the aesthetic or the functionality, but, you know, what that brand might mean to them on, you know, on a personal level. And it was very interesting just to kind of think about how that affects our culture from a mindshare perspective.
Liam, I want to turn your question around back to you. I'm curious what your answer would be to your own question.
I realized about 2 minutes ago that you might ask that. So I guess for fiction, definitely into science fiction. Like I said, having not read for many years, when I got back into it, I started with, I think it was Ender's Game, mm-hmm. which I managed to avoid the spoiler to. So that was definitely gripped me, and I stay up too late reading that a lot. As a Christian, I read the Bible a lot.
Sure.
And then for nonfiction, Predictably Irrational has.
Hi, this is Matt.
And Sean.
From Two Black Guys.
With good credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Right now on a special edition of Tools and Weapons, Brad Smith is sharing a vision for what Microsoft calls the new AI economy. It's an idea rooted in technological revolutions of the past, like the printing press, which created a vibrant marketplace of related innovations, ultimately leading to an explosion of books and readers. But he doesn't just give a history lesson. In the episode, Brad lays out the tangible ways that Microsoft is providing infrastructure and other support to those leading the charge of the new AI economy. And he explains the importance of using that infrastructure to ensure equitable access to AI to people all over the world. To stay current on insights from voices at the center of the conversation on AI, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you like to listen.
Change the way I think about how we think, and that we're not always aware of why we do what we do.
That's great. I'm curious, before we wrap up here, if you guys have any questions for each other, now that you've sort of gotten to hear each other's stories. I know that's sort of an awkward thing to throw out there sometimes, so you may not, but don't be afraid to throw out a question if you've got one right now. This is that part at the end of a conference when you ask if anyone has any questions. Like, and they're like,
we're trying not to put you on the spot, but you sort of, yeah.
Let me ask Justin this.
Okay.
Because you work with Quincy Jones,
mm-hmm.
sure you have some idea of him as a person. Are there any memorable moments that you could share that wouldn't get anyone in trouble? Well, I'm just curious.
One thing that's worth mentioning, and I had mentioned it to you earlier, Roger, but when the articles came out, I'm not one that likes to, I don't interact a whole lot with, you know, whatever. But when you guys actually covered it, when these articles came out, the interviews with Quincy and people, I think the internet was like, is he crazy? Uh-huh. Whatever. And it's like, and when I read it, I loved it because it really did capture what it's like to sit down and have a relaxed conversation with him. But when it was written in print, all of the things that contextualized what he was saying made it seem so much kind of more, I guess,
sensational,
nonsensical. And
it's the difference between email and talking to someone, right? I mean, how many times do we run in every day where we say something in email or we say something in Slack even, mm-hmm. and people are like, react in a way they're like, oh no, I didn't mean that, because it's written. The written word always plays differently.
Well, and it, you know, I mean, Tom and Roger and I talk all day, every day, and we do that constantly. Where constantly, I'm like, well, all right. And Tom's like, no, I didn't mean it. Yeah. You know, there is something lost when you're not, face to face, so to
speak. Also, he is an incredible human being. One memory, the thing that pops into my mind, the first thing was one of the first times I was at his house. It was, we were hanging in his living room, and it's him, Candy's with me, and his daughters, Rashida and Kidada. And Candy, she's a black lab, so she's a real lover. Mm-hmm. And we're all pretty much on the floor, you know, just hanging, and they're petting Candy, and Candy was just like sprawled out, you know. One paw was on Rashida's leg, the other one is on Kidada, and Quincy was just like, oh my gosh, you know, like Candy. Oh my goodness. He was just so taken aback by how comfortable Candy was. And pretty much ever since then, I think my name has become Candyman, and that can be very embarrassing.
Aww.
in public. Cause yeah, I'll be doing a performance, and if he makes an appearance and he shows up and he goes, you know, from the audience, Candyman. I'm like, stop saying that. He's the best, though. We love him.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where, like, nobody else understands why he's saying that, unless they've now heard you tell the story, right?
So, yeah.
Right. Well, any other questions at all? Even questions for us that you guys have?
Nope. Gotta say, I love what you guys do. I love the format that you guys created. And, As somebody, I think, you know, as somebody who's a part of the Patreon group, it's you do a fantastic job of creating, I think, what is the ideal situation with the Patreon format, which is where, like, it's an engaged audience. And I'm also very glad to see how you guys are constantly thinking of new ideas. It makes it very interesting to be involved, you know, in the Patreon thing.
Oh,
so
thanks. Yeah,
definitely kudos on that.
That's so nice to hear.
Yeah. We try to keep coming up with new things so we don't fall in a rut.
Yeah, keep it spicy.
For sure.
It's funny. My other question is about an old thing is, pick of the day. I used to love pick of the day.
You're the one.
I'm the one. Am I the only one? No,
it's not quite that bad, but pick of the day was definitely a thing that a few people really liked. And the rest of the audience, it's not that they didn't like it. It was just when we kind of stopped doing it, nobody really complained. So it was one of those things where it took more work than it was getting back. So we sort of, if pick of the day still exists just through email, right? Like if you have a pick or a cool thing, you can send it to email and Sarah will read it in the mailbag. And so that way we don't have to force it to happen because it's a segment every day.
Yep. I did enjoy that, just kind of reiterating that, just because it pointed me to a lot of things that I would not thought that I would have needed to go explore. Right. where it brought something to top of mind that I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And even if I just looked at it, I was like, oh, that doesn't quite do what I was thinking it was doing based on the, you know, the one line description. It was kind of a neat feature, just as food for thought.
Maybe what we could do, it's because I don't want to have to force it every day, because then it starts to get, it gets watered down. But maybe when someone sends us a pick, we could call it out more as like, ooh, it's a patron pick, you know, and that might encourage more people to send them. And you still get that benefit of being introduced to some things that you wouldn't otherwise know about.
And encourage people to sign up for the Patreon.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. All at the same time. Well, thanks you guys all for joining us. Let's go around the horn and tell folks what you want them to know about you, if it's where they can follow you on Twitter or a website or anything. We'll start with you, Justin. Where could folks find out more about you?
You can find me on my website. It's just www.justincoughlin.com. And my Twitter is pretty sad. I try to keep it updated or be engaged, but it's not my favorite platform. Things that are going on. I have two CDs that came out in the last year. One is called Coming Home. It's produced by Quincy. And it's a bunch of originals and some covers. I did a Sufjan Stevens cover called John My Beloved, and then we covered Strawberry Fields. And then for the holidays, I also made a CD called Silent Night, which is a solo piano, and it's more, it's quite Catholic, I would say, in that it's kind of sad, but I like to say it's contemplative, and so I explore some older hymns, and it's definitely more of a quiet, it's not a Michael Bublé Christmas. So those are there. And then the film Keep On Keeping On is the one that featured myself. And I do make a cameo in Quincy's.
Oh,
so
very cool.
You can see me there.
Keep your eyes open for that, too. It's JustinCoughlin.com, KAUFLIN, if anyone is trying to remember it, JustinCoughlin.com. Michael, what about you? Where can people find more of what you could do?
Well, similarly to Justin, my Twitter is mostly a place where I lurk. But if someone wanted to follow me on my very occasional post or wanted to reach out and chat games with me or whatnot, it's mparker546 is my Twitter. And I post there mostly when I'm at game conventions and see cool things.
Cool. Excellent. Check it out. mparker546. And of course, Liam, tell us not only what's going on at Focus Software, but anything else about yourself that you want folks to know.
Yeah, for sure. I should put a plug in for Focus. It's funny, when Michael was talking about his analytics of inventory and velocity of sales and all that sort of thing, that's what my company software does for inventory, retail, manufacturing, all that sales, all that stuff. So definitely check that out if you're involved in any of those sort of things. You can check out my website. It's pretty bare, but liamhughes.com, and includes a link to the Focus website and my Twitter, where I don't post anything. But you can send me a message if you want to know anything else.
Well, thanks to these folks and everybody who supports us on Patreon, patreon.com/DTNS, allowing us to continue to do the show. Of course, our goal every month, this month is no exception, is to have one more patron than last month. So if you're not already supporting us, you're not already a member, there's lots of cool perks in there. Get in at patreon.com/DTNS and become one of the people that pushes us over the line.
Speaking of people who contribute to our show, our email address is feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. We're also live Monday through Friday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 21:30 UTC. And you can find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live.
We will be back, sort of, in a way, tomorrow with the predictions results show. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Very slick, Tom.
Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. From a local business to a global corporation,
partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.